Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of Living Well with Kathleen Saunders, your weekly podcast where we discuss the financial, physical, spiritual, and social well-being of everyday people like you and me. The information shared in this show is for general information purposes only and should not be used to make any personal changes to your lifestyle or health without consulting the appropriate financial, medical, or healthcare professionals. Sydney Schindel is a holistic nutritionist and the founder of Veritas Wellness. She's a certified nutritional practitioner and former national level synchronized swimming coach. With a decade of coaching experience in the sports realm, she's able to apply the similar approaches to motivating clients to reach their health and wellness goals. She believes that by providing the right knowledge and tools, clients are able to develop and sustain their own foundation of good health. Through her work in professional kitchens, as well as her love of travel, Sydney has a vast array of skills and knowledge about food, culinary techniques, spices, and herbs. She believes that healthy food should never be boring and is happy to share her nutritious and tasty recipes with clients. Veritas Wellness was created out of a desire to share her love for real food and a healthy, well-balanced lifestyle with local communities and businesses. She was inspired by her experiences in other countries where whole foods and natural remedies are still deeply rooted in tight-knit communities. Sydney is an active member of the New Westminster community and believes that hands-on workshops and community events are an integral part of sharing her knowledge with others. Well, hello there, Sydney, and thank you so much for being my guest again today.
Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to speaking with you and having you share with us on the importance on gut health.
Definitely, and I'm excited to be here and share that because I feel like this term is becoming more and more of a buzzword of, you know, understanding gut health and how our gut and our brain are connected. And there's a lot of that information out there, but today my goal is really just to share a little bit of the foundational knowledge around gut health and understanding what that means. So hopefully there will be some good takeaways for your listeners today.
Awesome. That sounds great. Tell us, what's the importance of gut health? Why is that so crucial to us?
So just to even kind of start to scratch the surface,
yes.
Your gut is home to the largest part of your immune system. And when we think about the immune system, especially in a time like now, we have to remember that it's not just about taking care of your immune system in terms of your sinuses and your lungs, et cetera. It's actually about gut health as well, because as Hippocrates put it, I'm sure we've heard this quote many times, but all disease begins in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept of gut health starts not only from the concept of, you know, choosing specific foods that we're eating, but also understanding how we're actually breaking those things down.
Right.
So, yeah, if we look at the concept of digestion, we always think about that as, you know, we are what we eat. We are what we eat. We kind of eat these good foods, and then those are going to break down for us, and they're going to provide us with energy, and we can be healthy because of the foods that we eat. That is actually only part of the picture, because at the end of the day, when we think about what humans need to live, obviously we need air that we breathe, we need water, we need food. And when we think about it, food is actually not the best idea of the definition, because we need amino acids coming from proteins, we need fatty acids coming from fats, we need glucose coming from carbohydrates, and we need all the vitamins and minerals that are attached to these things when they're coming from real whole food sources, right? So when we look at that, yes, it's ideal to look at where we find that on our plate, but that's only part of the picture, because on a cellular level, we need those things, but how do we actually get them into our cells?
Good question.
And everyone thinks it's just digestion, but that's not actually the case. Digestion is the sorting part. It's the absorption and the assimilation that's actually key to us using those nutrients that we're providing our body with.
True.
So the best way I can give this as an analogy is, imagine if you had to go to the recycling depot.
Okay.
And you have a recycling depot, so you have your all of your cans and your bottles and your plastic containers and plastic bags and whatever else you have in the backseat of your car or in your trunk. And you taking them to the recycling depot is only the beginning part of the sorting process. Because at the end of the day, when you get to that sorting facility, we still have to separate them into their individual units, mm-hmm. right? We have to put the cans in one spot, the glass bottles in another, plastic bags here. And then we can actually start to sort them, clean them, and then break them down in the way that we need to break them down to be recycled again.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully visually that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. And we can kind of think about that as the concept of us sorting, mm-hmm. and that would be digestion. And then the next step is actually us absorbing and assimilating it, so putting it to use. So if we continue with the recycling example, then the absorbing and assimilation would be us actually taking those plastic cans or plastic bottles and then taking them to the next facility where we're going to break them down and make something new out of them. Mm-hmm. That's the absorption and assimilation process that we have kind of not really touched on in popular, like pop culture, nutrition, or kind of reading things on the internet these days.
Mm-hmm.
So the next step is us actually putting that to use in our cells. Right? Mm-hmm. We have to absorb it into the system. It's sent through our bloodstream into the liver, and then the liver gets first pick of nutrients, and we can kind of shuttle everything to where it needs to go. And so if we're thinking about human digestion and absorption and assimilation in a nutshell, mm-hmm. that is it. It's basically taking your cans and bottles to the recycling depot, sorting them into their individual kind of separate containers, and then those get taken away to facilities where we can break them down and use them for new things. So we kind of skip over that, or we kind of blur over the lines of absorption and assimilation in kind of modern day pop wellness culture of saying, oh, you are what you eat, but it's actually you are what you absorb and assimilate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The next step is honestly just to kind of backtrack a second and go back to the idea of this system can be, you know, can run very healthily. It can run very smooth in terms of, if you think back to the recycling depot, you can have this running very well and very easily if you are providing the recycling depot with like a good system. Everything's running up and with new, maybe we'll say not new materials, but kind of like a good functioning system where there are rules and regulations in place. Things get absorbed or things get passed into different sections. And this is an easy to use and easy to maneuver system. That would be the ideal scenario for human digestion. Mm-hmm. Right? You're going to eat certain foods. They are chewed properly. So we have smaller chunks of food coming into the system. We have good tools in place. So we have good digestive juices in the form of hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes. We have good motility. So that's the actual physical mechanical process of kind of squeezing our muscles in our digestive system to push things through. And we also have healthy cells or healthy gut cells to actually pull these nutrients in so they can actually be sent to the liver.
Right.
So if you think about this from like, I know this sounds odd coming from a holistic nutritionist, but if you think about this from like a mechanistic point of view and thinking about your body as kind of like a like that recycling factory, you can see how if it runs smoothly, everything would make sense. You could get as much out of these materials as possible. And that way what you're left with on the other end, to kind of keep things light, is that what's left over is the things that we couldn't recycle, the things that we can't really access or use. Mm. That would be the ideal scenario for the human digestive system.
Yeah, I love your analogies because, you know, I'm a very visual person, and you putting it out that way really helped put a better picture in my mind of how this whole system works. I really appreciate the way you're teaching that, Sydney. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I always like to teach in that way because not everyone listens to things auditorily. Not everyone looks at things in terms or reads words. So I like to try and paint as many pictures as I can, especially when you're talking about something so complex, something as complex as the human digestive system. So making it accessible is what I try and do.
Yeah. And you just did that. It's awesome. Beautiful.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the importance of the system is what we're going to discuss today, the idea of gut health and how to keep that facility clean, how to keep things running smoothly. And before we dive into that, it's also important to note that this system is connected to other systems. So if we're thinking back to this kind of visual process, we have to remember that the recycling depot is only part of your body's whole city, if you think about it like a city, right? You have the recycling depot, and then once things are going to be sent away from that recycling depot, you also have roadways, right, that are going to take things to other destinations. So think about that kind of like your bloodstream. Right? Your bloodstream is going to send things to areas where we can then use them for other purposes.
Yes, that's awesome.
And we also have electricity, or kind of we can think about this as electric or radio signals, or almost like I wouldn't say Wi-Fi, because it, those would be more so neurotransmitters, but let's say like an Ethernet cable, something that's attached from one destination to the other, and we can receive signal, right? Old school internet. And that would be the idea of your gut being connected to other parts of your body.
Right.
And so the whole gut-brain connection idea is where we can look at the concept of our gut and our brain being intimately connected. So the term gut-brain connection comes down to the fact that they are actually intimately linked through something called the vagus nerve. Yes, and this is a very interesting nerve because it doesn't just connect the gut and the brain. It actually connects a variety of different organs as well. It kind of checks in the heart and the lungs, and kind of just keeps the whole system connected to make sure that things are running smoothly and to make sure that we are safe if we're hungry, if we're feeling thirsty, if we're scared. All of these things are kind of sent through on this Ethernet cable to kind of keep communication with one system to the other.
Awesome. That's amazing.
And the big thing about this system is it's not just a one-way street, right? It's not just a one-way communication system where the brain can then send out signals to the gut or to other areas of the body, but we'll focus here on the gut. It's not just the brain saying, hey, gut, are you okay? What do you need? Are you hungry? It actually goes both ways. So the gut can talk to the brain and the brain can talk to the gut, because inside your gut, it's kind of like its own computer, essentially. Your gut is home to its own nervous system, and it's called the enteric nervous system. Sometimes it's also called the second brain. And this is where that idea of people saying, oh, that gut feeling, or, oh, I have that gut feeling where my something doesn't feel good, or, oh, I've got butterflies in my stomach because I'm concerned, or I'm excited. And that's where that term actually comes from, because inside your gut, there are neurons. So we actually feel that sensation. It's not just you kind of making it up. It's actually neurons that are sending those signals from your gut to your brain.
Transmitters.
And so inside your gut, inside that enteric nervous system, it's home to about 100 million neurons, all feeling and deciphering what's going on in the gut.
Wow. 100 million. Wow.
100 million neurons. Wow. So that's a lot of sensory material there, kind of feeling and deciphering what's going on inside that part of your system.
That's amazing.
It is. It's really cool, because that way, that part of your brain can send signals. So that part of your gut can send signals to your brain saying, hey, things are, you know, going well, or oh, we're experiencing some cramping, etc. You can kind of have the signal go both ways. The same way that the gut can send signals to the brain can send signals to the gut. So let's say your brain or your eyes see food. Right? Your eyes are seeing food and we're smelling food, and that can send signals to the gut saying, oh, it looks like we have a good meal coming up. Let's start to secrete some digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid. That's why we start to salivate, right? It's not your gut kind of just having an intuition to say, oh, I feel like there's food there. It's your brain sending that signal to your gut, right? And then on the other way around, we have the gut who can also send signals back up to the brain saying, oh, I think we ate something a little bit strange, or, oh, something's not quite right here. Let's tell the brain that something needs to be corrected, right? So this can go both ways.
So when the brain gets that system that something is not going quite right, what happens?
This can show up in a variety of different ways for different people. But if we're thinking about this, let's say from the idea of something very straightforward, like food poisoning, you get the cramping in your digestive system, and you might also start to feel a sense of like nervousness and panic, right?
Okay.
So that is part of your brain or your gut sending signals to your brain saying, hey, something's not right. We need to figure out what's going on here. And as part of that, you also might feel that sense of anxiety. We can also see this connection here, Kathleen, when we look at a case of something like IBS.
Right.
So if we're looking at a case of irritable bowel syndrome, where people are experiencing changes in gut motility. So let's say that they're experiencing gassing and a gas and cramping, and maybe they experience loose stools on a regular basis. That also ties in, interestingly enough, with anxiety and sometimes depression. Okay. And this is where that concept of chicken or the egg comes in. We don't know if the anxiety and those sensations cause changes in gut motility, or if it's the gut motility and let's say disagreements with certain foods, mm-hmm. and let's say some gut sensitivity that we'll talk about in a minute here, and changes to gut flora, so little bacteria that live there, kind of sending signals back to the brain saying, ooh, nothing, something's not quite right, and that could cause the anxiety. So we don't know which one comes first, and it depends from person to person. But this highway system, this vagus nerve, is the reason why we feel that in both places. And this is very prominent in conditions like IBS.
I see. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the enteric nervous system, there's two other things that are important to note. Aside from the fact that it's home to 100 million neuron cells, which is incredible within itself, it also is the home of trillions and trillions of bacteria.
Wow.
Yes. So the saying kind of goes, you're more bacteria than you are you.
Incredible.
I know. It's weird. Don't freak out. but you're actually home to more bacteria in terms of, if we're going to count kind of cell for cell, than human cells.
Wow.
I know. It's kind of crazy to think about. If we look at these bacteria, and we'll dive into a little bit more on that in a second, but these guys are actually going to be somewhat responsible, very responsible for creating our neurotransmitters in our gut.
Okay.
Yeah. So the last thing I'll mention about the vagus nerve here is that it's part of this kind of internet highway or internet cable that goes from the gut to the brain. And part of the responsibility of our gut bacteria is to make certain products out of the offerings that we give them. The offerings would be our proteins and our carbohydrates and our fats. And we can actually turn some of our amino acids coming from proteins into neurotransmitters. Mm. So the precursor to serotonin is made in our gut. We make GABA in our gut and we send that to the brain.
Okay, right.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of kind of setting you up here for gut health and understanding that, we have to remember what is going on in our city before we talk about what happens when the city's infrastructure fails. So in our city, right, you in your gut city, or that kind of one section of neighborhood, we'll call it your neighborhood, you have trillions and trillions of bacteria. Mm-hmm. And they are helping us to produce these neurotransmitters that are very important to our overall health. Depending on which textbook you read and which research you're reading, between 70 to 90% of your serotonin is made in your gut and then sent to your brain.
Okay. I'm just going to ask this quickly. You may say this is not something for you to discuss today. The vagus nerve, will you touch on what happens if that gets damaged?
I don't know if we'll touch on that today, but the vagus nerve, in terms of the connection with the gut brain, like what I can mention about that for today is that that's also one of the reasons why when we're in a stressful situation, we feel changes to our gut. So let's say you were extremely stressed, but you decide you still want to go for a workout. So you swallow a big, you know, you eat like I always use this example because it's just easy to think about. You eat a bagel and cream cheese. Okay. You eat a bagel and cream cheese after a stressful day, but you say, you know what? I need to go to the gym. So you swallow the bagel and cream cheese and you go to the gym and have an hour long, stressful, intense workout. But you notice that the whole time your gut feels kind of just heavy. You feel like that bagel is like a rock in there and it's not really digesting.
Right.
The vagus nerve is why? Because it connects or it controls what we secrete in terms of digestive juices and enzymes. So in a state of stress, we can slow down digestion.
Right.
So digestion is not important when we're in a stressful state because in that moment, what's important to our cells is to run away from a tiger. That's literally what our cells are still thinking. We haven't evolved yet to determine what stresses are good and what stresses are bad. So in that case, that vagus nerve, while it's not damaged, it's still sensing kind of what needs to take precedent in the whole city of you.
Right. I've heard also, I heard also that's why it's important never to eat while you're stressed.
Yes. So it's kind of two-way, because you do want to make sure you're eating if you're in a stressful state. So let's say you're going through a hard time in terms of, you know, loss or change or finances. And if you're not eating, obviously, then the infrastructure of your system is going to start to slowly break down. But when you're stressed, yes, you will not be digesting for that reason. Because when we are in a stress state, what is important at the moment is to breathe in a different pattern. You're going to shunt blood to your legs. I think we talked about this in our last session as well. And in that moment, you're secreting a lot of stress hormones. So we're not talking about digestion. Our body's not concerned about the recycling at this point. It really just wants to fix the pathways that are kind of keeping the highways clear. And that's about it.
That's its priority at the time.
That is the priority. Mm-hmm. So that's where we start to see when people are very stressed, that this can actually kind of segue us into the concept of what happens when our recycling depot, and what happens when our infrastructure starts to break down, because this vagus nerve plays an important role there. If we're in a stressful state, we do not digest as well. And what happens there is that that whole process of sorting out the recycling changes. So in a stressful state, we are not secreting as much of our digestive enzymes, but we're probably still eating.
Yes.
And what happens here is that that means we're not bathing our food in the adequate levels of hydrochloric acid, so it's stomach acid. We're not, that could also mean that we're not sterilizing pathogens that come in on our food, because yes, there are bacteria everywhere. It's okay, but the stomach acid plays a very important role in neutralizing that pathogen that could be on your food, as well as activating a specific enzyme that's actually very important for the breakdown of protein. Without hydrochloric acid, we do not make that, or we do not activate it. And without hydrochloric acid, we don't create specific compounds that are important for us to absorb certain vitamins, in particular B12. So a lot to think about there. Yeah, so even before we get started, Kathleen, the biggest suggestion I can make for that is, if you eat when you're stressed, the biggest thing you can do is just take a couple, I know this sounds almost too simple, but just take a couple deep breaths, sit down and eat your meal, going very slowly. We are spend so much time eating on the go, or eating in the car, or all these things that can actually affect our digestion that we're about to discuss. But before we even get into that, just the concept of taking a couple deep breaths, turning off the TV, not eating in your car,
mindful
chewing
eating.
Your food.
Yeah.
Yes, mindfulness is the biggest thing there. The chewing of the food also makes a very big difference, and putting your fork down between bites.
Still working on that one.
It's a good challenge.
It is. I heard also Sydney was saying that you should chew your food at least 30 to 70 times until it goes liquid.
Yes. And so it's actually quite useful to do that. I usually challenge my clients to start with 20 to 30. And I find that depending on the food, I don't really need 70.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're definitely doing that to increase the surface area. So it's kind of like, if we're using that analogy again, it's basically like kind of getting to the recycling depot instead of just three big trash bags full of different types of bottles and cans and plastic things. You've already kind of pre-sorted them, or you've already started to think about your game plan. So when you chew, you're increasing surface area, and you're also bathing, if you're eating carbohydrates, you're bathing those in the enzymes that break down carbohydrates, and you're just increasing surface area. So we have more ability, or our enzymes later on in our system have more surface area to work on to break down those items further.
Makes sense. Well,
And then the last thing I'll make about the vagus nerve here, because it's also very important, is that we can actually keep reactivating the vagus nerve in a negative, or in a kind of more stress-related way, by our breathing. So because the vagus nerve is also connected to our lungs, if we're breathing in that shallow breathing pattern that many of us tend to do, right? We're kind of breathing in that upper part of our chest.
Right.
The more we do that, the more we're kind of sending our brain that signal that we're still in a stressful state. Because a good deep breath is the kind that you don't think about. It's kind of in the deep, deep part of your belly that's very relaxed and very calm. And that can also send signals back to the brain saying, hey, we're calm, everything's nice and safe. But if you're constantly doing that, like, kind of breath that some of us tend to do, or just kind of happens when you're not really thinking about your breathing pattern, that can actually activate that stress part of your brain as well.
Wow, this gut-brain connection is really serious.
It is. Yeah. But it's not to be taken with like, just something to be worried about and make you more stressed. But it's just something to kind of be aware of, because everything in our body is connected. Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
yes,
everything.
Yes.
And we're also extremely connected to our microbes. Mm. So the human microbiome is so important to gut health. Because remember, you are more bacteria than human. In terms of the weight, it's about, I think the estimate that I last read was between 5 to 7 pounds of your body weight is actually microbes.
5 to 7 pounds?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. Wow. And they're very helpful. So mm-hmm. we always talk about the microbiome, and you'll kind of hear the terms good and bad.
Yeah.
But before we do that, mm-hmm. when it comes down to microbes, microbes are simply just tiny living organisms. Right? So they're bacteria, mm-hmm. fungi, protozoas, or viruses. That's what microbes are.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of a microbiome, what that definition is a collective of all of the microbes in one environment. So a community of microbes. Right? Mm-hmm. Let's say your kitchen countertop, if it's dirty, might have its own microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's gross, but that's something you kind of probably take care of now and again, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of our human microbiome, we have a human microbiome as well. It's a collective of microbes that live inside us and on us,
mm-hmm.
because we have some that live on our skin. We have some that live in our scalp. We have some that live in our mouth. We have a mouth microbiome that we're now learning much more about, which is very interesting,
mm-hmm.
as well as the fact that we have a gut microbiome.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the gut microbiome is what we'll kind of spend the most time talking about here, because they play a key role in our neurotransmitter production. They play a key role in our immune system,
mm-hmm.
and their balance is quite important.
Mm-hmm.
So,
when
we look at the term mm-hmm. balance, this is where we kind of get that idea of good microbes versus bad microbes.
Right.
You know, you have good ones versus bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not actually that simple and cut and dry. You actually have a blend of different types of microbes that kind of live in harmony. And when we start to see certain microbes overgrowing and starting to, let's say, take over, that's when we start to see changes to gut health. So that's when we start to see cases, let's say, of candida, or we're starting to see cases potentially of irritable bowel syndrome, or we're looking at cases of chronic fatigue where there's no answer, or we're looking at, let's say, this shifting and creating that kind of IBS picture where we don't really know where the root cause is. So that human microbiome is so important to understand, but it's also important to remember that we all have a blend of these different kind of good and bad microbes within us. We all have candida living inside of us right now.
Mm.
We all do,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's when it goes out of hand
right.
that it becomes a problem.
Okay, understood.
Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about our microbes is that we inherit these. So we actually inherit them from birth, from our mothers, when we're born. So that kind of starts to set up your colony. Your colony is different than your brother's colony, than your sister's colony, than your partner's colony.
Mm-hmm.
Your gut microbiome changes throughout your life, but you start off with your gut microbiome when you're born. And depending on how you're born, be it a natural birth or a C-section birth, that will also alter your gut microbes.
Interesting. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting side topic to look into, that if you're born in a natural birth, you are given your mother's microbes. If you're not, then you're given the microbes of the doctors and nurses around you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so they're actually starting to be more mindful of doing what they call a swab. And so they'll take your mother or samples of your mother's tissue in kind of that area and then swab the baby to make sure that it's kind of being passed down that way rather than just being introduced from foreign people.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Could go on a whole topic on just microbiomes.
Oh my gosh, we could go on forever about this, but I'll keep this part short.
Yep,
the last thing is that this microbiome changes with time. So your colony will change depending on your surroundings, depending on the foods that you eat, depending on your genetics, and depending on your stress levels, because different types of microbes thrive in different environments. So if we're looking at some of the negative effects that we could have on our microbiome, the big ones that come up are kind of the exposure to things like antibiotics, right? So that term there, antibiotics, literally means anti-life.
Mm-hmm.
So if we start to see anti-life, like some with antibiotics, we are wiping out both our good and bad gut flora. And we do need to understand that that will also change kind of what comes back after that, how we recolonize after that.
Right. Gotcha.
And then we'll also see changes to our gut microbiome due to the foods that we eat. So different microbiomes, as I mentioned, microbes like different things. So we'll find that some of those quote unquote bad gut bacteria like different types of sugars. Right? So they thrive off of sugary foods. They thrive off of refined carbohydrates. And if we're eating a variety of those different foods and not really providing our good guys with the types of foods that they like to eat, this can also cause a bacterial overgrowth. And so this type of bacterial overgrowth can start to lead to cases of IBS, right? So let's say we have a picture for you where someone, you know, was sick a couple of times, they had a couple of rounds of antibiotics, they live a pretty stressful lifestyle, which also changes how we absorb and digest and eliminate. And then in terms of, let's say, food choices, we're eating a lot of sugary foods. And when we try and quit those sugary foods, your brain still says, but I want sugar. Partially that's to do with your gut microbiome, gut microbes, pardon me, asking for that sugary content. And this can kind of lead to that vicious cycle of people eating refined sugary foods and feeling the symptoms of, let's say, something like IBS. So well, bacterial overgrowth can be a pretty common cause of IBS.
Would that, Sydney, then also show up in food allergies, food sensitivities, where a person would have issues?
They can, definitely. So this leads us into the concept of when we start to see changes to our gut microbiome, this changes our gut tissue. And the immune system there is called the MALT, which is the mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue. For kind of fancy terms, and it surrounds the intestines, and this makes up a big part of your immune system. So when we start to see changes to our gut flora, this can lead to what we call leaky gut or intestinal permeability is the more scientific term for that. And when we look at cases of like increased permeability, then we start to see, yes, changes to immune function. So when we are looking at intestinal permeability, what that really means is that your cells that line your digestive tract are not really sticking together the way that they should.
Okay.
And to give you like a visual of this, the best way I can do it is to like put both your hands together, like side by side, like palms out away from you, and kind of do little jazz hands with your fingers. By doing that, I hope you guys are doing this at home with me, because I'm definitely doing
this right now.
So yeah, thumbs to thumbs and then palms away from you. And if you do your little wiggly fingers, that's kind of what your enterocytes look like. This is the cell that lines your digestive tract. And the palm of your cell is where you're going to find like the nucleus and all the different organelles and the mitochondria. But these little fingers, literally like your fingers, are what we actually use to absorb and bring nutrients into that cell. And your digestive cells, so the cells that line your intestines, are only one cell deep. They're not layered like skin. Like you have layers and layers of skin, but your intestinal cells are quite, that's it. That's all you got. So when they line up, they kind of line up exactly like that, like hand to hand to hand to hand like that, with these little fingers that are used to pull in the nutrients. And when we look at the term leaky gut, it would kind of be like where your thumbs are. The little patching that holds them together is slightly open. And so things can actually pass between the cells there, and we end up with food particles and bacteria and, let's say, toxins even as well, that end up on the other side of the digestive or of that cell, and that can elicit an allergic reaction, or that can elicit a sensitivity, like that food sensitivity that we're talking about. Because an allergic reaction is defined as like an anaphylactic style of, of reaction that's mediated by a different response, but we'll call this a food sensitivity or a food intolerance. And interesting enough with this, this can also lead to interesting kind of scenarios, like if we're looking at certain cases of arthritis can actually be due to this. It's called like a reactive arthritis. And we can also see this in scenarios like, let's say, just general low-grade inflammation throughout the body. Or we could look at this as also being affected by, let's say, damage to the cells. So we call that leaky gut, plus dysbiosis. So imbalance of our gut flora, that can lead to chronic yeast infections. That can lead to a diagnosis of an autoimmune condition if it's left like this for too long, right? There's tons of different things that can show up. Some people, dysbiosis and leaky gut shows up as acne, eczema, psoriasis, joint pain, brain fog, anxiety, IBS, IBD, acid reflux. Right? That can also be a part of this picture too.
Wow. And it affects each person differently, obviously, because what would affect you will not necessarily affect me, correct?
Exactly. Correct. Wow. And that's what makes this so difficult to not just diagnose, but just to kind of put your finger on. Mm-hmm. Because if we're looking at a case of dysbiosis and we're looking at that intestinal permeability, it's exactly that. Your symptoms could be completely different than mine. Mm-hmm. And then we don't really know where to start. We have to kind of track back what we've been eating, track back what how we feel after we eat, track back all these different things to determine what is actually causing this for us. But yes, it could just show up as just general fatigue in some people. So it's a really interesting point to discuss and a good place to start if you have, you know, specific symptoms, but mm-hmm. you have no diagnosis and you're not quite sure what it is. Doesn't mean that you should Dr. Google yourself and diagnose yourself with this, right. But it's just something to consider, right? Just to
Very
see,
true.
Oh, like what's going on here? Maybe my gut's not happy and we can kind of figure out if dietary changes will make a difference.
Right. And I guess too, after the dietary changes and you're still experiencing something, then you do need to take it a little bit more seriously. Maybe go to your naturopathic doctor and get a proper diagnosis so you know exactly what to treat.
Definitely, mm-hmm. for sure. And so we'll walk you guys through at the end here a couple of steps that you can take in terms of foods to eat and foods to avoid if you are experiencing some of these symptoms. But if they do continue, yes, getting a couple of tests done at a naturopath or going to see your GP as well is also an ideal scenario if these steps do not help you, mm-hmm. right? Because this can... especially if we're getting a diagnosis of autoimmune and someone already is experiencing autoimmune, that has to be monitored, right? Whether you like it or not, so you just want to make sure that that is under control.
Right.
And even something like acid reflux, because once again, that acid reflux can cause long-term damage and can lead to cancer as well.
Seriously. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in terms of dysbiosis and leaky gut or intestinal permeability, I really want people to call it that, not leaky gut. In the long term, this could be a problem in the long term, because at the end of the day, we might have experienced foods that have caused a bit of irritation, or we might have had a meal that we ate on the go, and that's okay, right? This life. But when we start to see this type of experience layered on year after day after day and week after week and year after year, this type of dysbiosis, as well as the inflammation that you might have caused in your digestive tract due to, let's say, eating too quickly and not having the same digestive function happen, which could cause damage to those little fingers if you do your jazz hands, which means low absorption and kind of more inflammation. In the long term, this becomes a problem, because then we start to see changes in immune function. Because remember, 60% of your gut is found around your, so 60% of your immune system is found around your gut.
Yeah, right.
Can also lead to changes in nutrient absorption, because think about your jazz hands, it's kind of what's going to pull the nutrients in. And if they were to kind of wilt and fall down, you wouldn't be able to pull as much nutrients into your system.
All right.
So this type of concern, both the dysbiosis and intestinal permeability, because they are separate, they're two different things.
Okay.
But this can lead to, let's say, potential for autoimmune. This can lead to cancers. Mm. This can lead to hormone imbalances. That's actually, interestingly enough, why some people have a harder time losing weight than others. Mm. It's not the only part of the picture, mm-hmm. but the hormone imbalance that can come from this, as well as the low, steady stream of kind of inflammatory, they're called cytokines, but they're like inflammatory cytokines that can also interfere with how we use and secrete our hormones. That can also lead to changes in weight and inability to lose weight. And last but not least, dysbiosis can definitely lead to metabolic diseases as well.
Sorry, what was that? Medical?
metabolic diseases.
Oh, metabolic, so right.
Yes, at cases of insulin resistance, and we're looking at, let's say, like metabolic syndrome and kind of getting into potentials for like type 2 diabetes. So it's not to scare you, it's just to be mindful of what goes on here in terms of what's going on in our guts and how it's not just the food that we eat, it's also the stress that we experience and how we deal with that stress and kind of what we do around the stress picture. Because I wish I could show you guys these images that I have as part of the slide deck that I like to talk about here. But remember that when you're experiencing stress, that changes your secretion of digestive enzymes and hydrochloric acid, which then changes what we're actually able to absorb and assimilate later on in the system, as well as changes, could also potentially change the type of microbes that are living in our gut. And then that change in our microbes can lead to changes in GABA and changes in serotonin, changes in the short chain fatty acids that we use for energy in our gut, as well as changes for what type of inflammatory molecules we're secreting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then this can also change how we feel. This can change kind of our mood. This can change how we sleep. And then the cycle can kind of repeat itself again, or we can go vice versa. Maybe we had some changes in the gut that made us feel more stressful, right? So or us feel more stressed. So there's kind of a two-way street here that can happen.
Right.
And then in terms of kind of putting some of the pieces together here, I want to leave you guys with kind of the concept of what we can do now. Now what? Mm-hmm. Rather than simply just kind of giving you the facts about, you know, what goes on in your gut and how we can look at this as kind of like a highway and thinking about your digestive system as the recycling depot that sorts everything before we send it on its way. We also have to figure out how to keep this city functioning, right? How to keep our highways moving, how to keep our microbes happy, and how to understand what to do if, let's say, things are compromised, or let's say the infrastructure is not moving the way that we want it to. So in terms of feeding the gut, the idea is to remember that we do want to eat food from a whole foods-based approach, right? So eating foods in a real whole food form will be an ideal way to ensure that we are getting the nutrients that we need to fuel ourselves, right? So food in its real whole food form, tons of colorful vegetables, healthy fats, quality proteins, so all be good places to start. As well as if we're looking at our healthy fats with a focus on what we call the omega-3s. It's an essential fatty acid that plays a very important role in reducing inflammation. You can find that in fatty fish. You can find that in chia and flax, although we don't do a great job of converting it. So supplementation might be ideal for that type of scenario. And if you do eat meat, bone broth is also actually a pretty useful option for gut health because of the fact that it contains high amounts of an amino acid called L-glutamine, which is very helpful for our little fingers, our little jazz hands that we talked about earlier. It's actually fuel for our intestinal cells.
I just bought some bones to make some bone broth today. So.
Oh, awesome. Perfect. Yeah. You do a long cook or a slow cook? Do you have a pressure cooker or a...
I have an Instapot. And I put it on for about 20 hours.
Ah, perfect. Yeah. The whole house will smell delicious.
It does. It's amazing. And it's really good for you, like you say.
Exactly. It reminded me that I have to get mine started too. And so aside from that, the other thing that we want to look at is feeding our gut microbes fiber. Mm-hmm. And this type of fiber is something that our gut likes to work with for fuel. And if we're looking at fiber in general, this having adequate fiber is ideal for digestion and helping to feed our gut, our little kind of gut microbes. But they really like a type of resistant starch. Okay. And it actually acts like a fuel source for them. So you'll find it in cassava, plantain, sweet potato, and green bananas. Mm-hmm. And you can also find it in white rice. If you cook the white rice and cool it down and cook it and cool it down multiple times, you can actually create resistant starch. But the best way to kind of think about it is if you ever had a green banana, like a banana that's not ripe yet, and you put it in your mouth and you get that weird starchy feeling.
Right, yeah.
That's the resistant starch.
Okay. Okay.
And you can actually follow that along with a banana. If you buy bananas that are green, and then you watch them turn yellow, and then you watch them turn spotty and brown, mm-hmm. that's actually the resistant starch turning into sugar over time through oxidation, like through being exposed to the air. So if you eat a green banana, you have that resistant fiber that your gut microbes really like.
Okay, interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of steps to kind of start to avoid or to look at what we can do to keep our microbes happy and kind of keep the balance between the good and the bad guys going on in our gut, as well as looking at how we can reduce the damage and inflammation to those little jazz hands, those little intestinal cells that we talked about. It's kind of the same principles will apply that we talk about in the realm of nutrition. It's removing those refined sugars and processed foods, removing trans fats, hydrogenated fats, and then for many people, removing dairy and gluten, and in some cases, all grains.
Right.
Okay. So those refined sugars are just, there's just so much sugar potential there that the microbes that are considered quote unquote bad, they really like sugar. So they can feed off of those and multiply and grow in a way that can be counterproductive to what we're trying to do in terms of working on our gut health.
So I have a question for you then. Is all sugar bad? I mean, what about if you eat raisins and dates and, you know, you have fruit? Is that considered the same as, you know, is all sugar considered equal?
So this question comes up all the time. Is all sugar created equal? Mm-hmm. Yes and no. At the end of the day, all sugar breaks down into sugar. All sugar will break down into glucose, and we're going to use glucose to make energy in our cells. But the biggest difference between, let's say, an apple that has sugar in it in comparison to a tablespoon of white sugar is the rate at which we can have access to that sugar. So that talks more so about, you know, blood sugar management, as well as what comes along for the ride with that apple. So that apple is going to have tons of nutrients attached to it, whereas that refined sugar is exactly that. It's just refined sugar with no nutritional value, just energy potential.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Right. Now, if we're eating tons of dates and raisins and things like that, that still could potentially negatively affect your microbes. But it depends also, once again, on quantity, right? If you're eating 10 to 20 dates a day, that's still an excessive amount of sugar, even though you have cut out white sugar. But if you're having a date as a treat here and there, and you have, let's say you don't have some sort of overgrowth of specific microbes, then that would be not a problem at all. So the goal really is to reduce your intake of basically sugars overall, but just be mindful of where that sugar comes from and what the purpose of you eating that sugar is.
Okay, good to know. Thank you.
Very good question. And then the other thing with that one, before I move on, is also just retraining your taste buds, right? So if you are replacing, let's say, refined sugar with coconut sugar or maple syrup, you're still just eating sugar, even though those types of sugar have more nutrients attached to them, right? So the goal would be to slowly change your taste buds over time to be more attuned to the fact that fruit is sweet, or the fact that you were using sugar as a way to, you know, palliate boredom or whatever it was.
A good way to do that maybe might be doing a sugar detox to help.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's where, if you look at, you know, diets like the Whole 30, and if you've ever looked through the steps of it, for the first, I think it's the first 2 weeks, they remove everything, including bananas.
Okay.
Like all refined sugars, everything else. And then by the end, you can add bananas back in. Okay. So that's a very, very strict restrictive diet if you're looking at a 30 days without sugar, but it's very interesting to know that they actually do remove the fruit aspect as well, because they want you to retrain your taste buds to be mindful of the fact that bananas are quite sweet and that fruit is quite sweet. And then in terms of the other foods, processed foods are pretty straightforward, and there are tons of additives that can actually irritate the gut lining. And if you think back to our little jazz hands that can pull the cells apart or kind of wedge their way through. Same thing goes for trans fats and hydrogenated fats. That type of fat is not read very well by the body. It's kind of like putting a bent key in a lock, right? And when we look at those types of fats, they're not natural. So if we're getting trans fat, it's not coming from a food-based source. There are not food based, pardon me, animal based source, because mm-hmm. there are tiny, minute amounts in animals.
Right.
But those ones we seem to break down. But the ones that we make when we heat up oils past when they should be heated, those guys are like a bent key in a lock. And so you're trying to put that in a lock and it doesn't quite work, and it can actually damage the lock itself. So that can cause inflammation and irritation to the gut, as well as on an actual cellular level. The cells don't really know what to do with it. And then with dairy and gluten, these are also two things that you can remove in terms of looking at gut health and ensuring that you have a happy gut, especially if you are experiencing those symptoms of IBS, or if you're experiencing, let's say, just chronic fatigue or joint pain or any of those things. You'll definitely be asked, if you work with a nutritionist or a naturopath, to remove dairy and gluten, because they are very inflammatory. Just the way that they break down and the actual molecules that they're made out of are pro-inflammatory molecules. So they can kind of light up inflammation in the body. With gluten in particular, gluten is going to be the protein that's found in certain grains like wheat, and we can look at that at barley as well, and rye and salt. And if we look at that particular compound in the zonulin that's found in it, I know it's a cool name, but it actually has a way of wedging itself between those two cells to cause irritation, and can actually increase that intestinal permeability that we were talking about. So if anyone's experiencing IBS, or if you're experiencing, like I mentioned, the joint aches and the brain fog and chronic fatigue, removing the refined sugar plus gluten mm-hmm. containing grains
right.
can be a really useful tool to mm-hmm. basically ensure that your gut is not being exposed to potential inflammatory molecules.
Approximately how long would you say that you need to refrain from these foods? Is there any certain time frame?
Good question. And if we're looking at this, this would be something that you'd have to think about as a long-term process,
okay.
because of the fact that we know that these things cause damage. So even if you remove them and then bring them back in, you might experience those symptoms again later on. But as a way to remove them and then seeing if that's to see what they're, if they're the ones that are actually causing that damage,
mm-hmm.
then you'd want to wait at least 30 to 60 days. Because the cells of your intestines turn over around 30 to 60 days. So you make new gut cells every 30 to 60 days.
Okay, good to know.
Mm-hmm. So your cells are constantly turning over, like mm-hmm. all over your body, your bones, your hair, everything.
Right.
And your gut cells, their time frame is about 30 to 60 days. So removing those and for the 30 to 60 day mark would be ideal, as mm-hmm. well as also adding in the good guys, right? Like adding in those real whole foods and foods that can be very helpful for digestion.
Mm-hmm.
And then potentially reintroducing things like dairy or grains if you saw fit. But obviously the goal would always be to keep those refined sugars out and processed foods out as much as possible, because mm-hmm. we know they're void of nutrients, right? They don't really have the nutrient components that we need for our city to run. It's kind of, I know this is going to be like a weird recycling analogy back to our recycling depot, but if you took your recycling to the recycling depot, we know we can make new plastic bottles out of, you know, milk jugs, and we can make new glass jars out of old glass jars. But if you take cling film, like, you're probably not going to be able to make much out of that cling film.
Right.
So I would kind of deem cling film to be like the refined foods of the recycling industry.
I love your analogies.
Well, I'm glad you like them. But that's basically the concept there. You want to work with raw materials that are going to provide you with, you know, long-term benefits, right?
So
those
yeah.
real whole foods have the energy potential in the form of, you know, proteins, carbs, and fats. But they also have the vitamins and minerals attached that help you keep your system running.
Mm-hmm. What about supplements? Do you recommend that? Are there any supplements mm-hmm. that you recommend? Should we be doing that?
Depending on the situation,
sure,
honestly,
sure.
But when we're looking at gut health, L-glutamine can be a very useful one for anyone who is experiencing IBS and IBD,
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that it acts as that fuel for the gut itself. L-glutamine has to be taken away from food, interestingly enough, for this purpose. If anyone's familiar here with kind of working out and sports nutrition supplementation, L-glutamine is also used as a supplement for building muscle or kind of repairing muscle tissue. but it has an affinity for that when you eat it with food. So it passes through the system, whereas if you eat it away from food, it tends to help the gut lining.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's beneficial.
You could also look at B vitamins.
Okay.
So B vitamins could be quite useful there. They help not only with proteins in the gut, but they also help us to metabolize our proteins, carbohydrates, and fats.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of other supplements, we could go into a couple of different places here. If we're looking at tissue, vitamin A in some places could be useful because of the fact that vitamin A has an affinity for gut health. It has an affinity for mucosal tissue. So that's why people take vitamin A for eye health, because its eye tissue has a mucus layer. So it can also be useful for gut as well, because it's full of mucus and it tends to actually have an affinity for mucosal cells. So vitamin A, but once again, too, that is a fat-soluble vitamin that you would need to be mindful of how much you take, but could be something worth looking into. And then if we're looking at other things that could be useful for gut health, vitamin C, just because it does reduce inflammation, fish oils, same thing, reducing inflammation.
Right.
And then we could also look at zinc, interestingly enough. Never take zinc away from food, though, because it does cause gastric distress.
Okay.
Zinc is a really interesting mineral because it actually plays a role in how we make hydrochloric acid, our stomach acid.
Right.
But it's a catch-22 because in order to actually absorb zinc in the diet, you need adequate levels of stomach acid.
Okay.
I know. Yeah. There's a lot of systems like that in the body where the irony is quite hilarious in terms of, like, you need this thing to absorb it, but you also need it to make it. So this is where that kind of vicious cycle can occur, where let's say you have low stomach acid and you're eating all the foods that contain zinc and whatever else, and you're not actually able to pull a lot of it in. So zinc supplementation could be part of a dietary plan there as well.
Okay, interesting.
And the last one I'll leave you guys with, because this question always comes up, is probiotics.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. You could work with a probiotic as well. When we're looking at quality of probiotic, you want to find one that has at least 15 billion CFUs, colony-forming units. But these are also important to remember that they're not yours. So they're not your microbes. Okay. So you have to remember that you have to kind of consider them as seeds, and you want to plant them in a garden that's going to be ready and willing to provide a place for these seeds to grow. So if you just take probiotics but you're still eating a poor quality diet, yes, you probably are still going to see some sort of a difference with the probiotics, but you want to make sure that they have a good environment to grow in. So rather than just throwing seeds in a sandbox, is the analogy I like to use, you want to make sure there's fertile soil there, right? So changing up your diet, looking at your sleep and your stress pattern, as well as doing some of the kind of supplementation protocol that we talked about as well, could be a good place to set your system up for them to receive these little microbes. And then depending on the person, because if we're looking at someone who has like a FODMAP concern, so that would be people who have issues with specific types of sugars, you would want to avoid the FOSs, the fructooligosaccharides, but a good probiotic should have on the label, if you look on the ingredient list, past the list of microbes, on the other ingredients, it should say FOS, and those are fructooligosaccharides, and those are those resistant starches, those fermentable fibers that are microbes like, the good guys like. So it's kind of like sending your kids to school with a snack, right? You want to make sure they have a snack for the road so they can actually get to where they need to go without, getting hungry.
So that would be like the plantains and the green bananas that you had mentioned earlier on.
Exactly, right. And so some people have issues with the fructooligosaccharides in certain cases, if we're getting into IBS and other conditions there. But for the most part, the probiotic with that compound shouldn't be an issue. But they also make good quality probiotics that don't have it for conditions where we have to kind of dive a little bit deeper in and see if those specific types of sugars are causing the problem. But that's like way more complex nitty-gritty stuff.
Okay, interesting. Very good. You know, Sydney, again, you've come on, you've brought excellent, excellent tips and advice and some suggestions that we can do to help ourselves have a good, healthy gut. Is there any final word that you want to say before we end this podcast today?
Thanks so much for having me on, Kathleen. And the last thing I'll leave you with is that even though we kind of talked about the fact that all diseases begin in the gut, we have to remember that there is not even just a two-way street. It's a 10, 20-way street between all of the different areas in our body. So while we can make changes to the gut, we also have to look through our dietary choices. We also have to remember to take care of the rest of the foundations, I mean, our sleep patterns and how that could be affecting our stress levels, our coping mechanisms, like our personal resilience, right? How we are dealing with stress. Our habits that we're kind of going through on a daily basis. Do we eat in our car? Are we eating on the go? Are we not sitting down and being mindful and thankful around our meals? All of these things can be extremely useful tools that can actually have a very large impact on your digestion and your gut health. So when you think about that, I hope that's helpful. And then the last thing, because there's two things I want to leave you there.
Sure.
A product of what you eat, you're actually a product of what you absorb and assimilate.
Right, that's true. Yes, I have this quote here that I want to share. It says, "Take care of your body. It's the only place you have to live."
Yes,
and that is so very true. Very true.
It is.
Yeah. So again, I want to thank you for sharing part of your Sunday morning with me. I appreciate you taking that time. And just to educate myself and my listeners, I know they've learned a lot today. We've got some good, valuable information that we can actually use and apply to our lives. Those of us who have health issues and those of us who don't have health issues, because health is wealth, right?
It is. All right. Most definitely. Well, thank you so much for having me on, Kathleen. I really appreciate you taking the time as well.
You're welcome.
Really fun just to share this.
No problem. Thank you, Sydney. You take care and have a great day. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed the topic and found something that you can apply to your own life. Don't forget to share this episode with your family and friends. And remember, live well daily.